Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with the Paranormal Report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley. And Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
Hello there, welcome back. Listen, last week we had an amazing response to my first true crime commentary. Words can't explain. I really do appreciate the comments that we had and the support we're getting for this commentary. I want to ask a favor of you also, though, is I want you to invite somebody, perhaps right now, pick up the phone and say, hey, tune in, listen to this. This is really good stuff. I want you to listen to the House of Mystery on KKNW and listen to Steve's commentary. Just take a minute and let somebody know, and invite somebody to listen in, if you will. Okay, tonight we will continue with the second part of how do detectives know when someone is lying to them. Last week we covered a few things. We're going to cover some more and wrap up the second part here. Let's talk about briefly the narrative answer format to questioning. Now, when you ask an open-ended question, and most of the time that's what you want to do, there are the occasions where you want to pinpoint an answer and you want a yes or no answer, but when you're asking an open-ended question, typically what you will get from the person who is answering you is 20 to 30% of that will be introduction, or they're going to prep what they're saying to you. The other 35 to 65% is the main context of what they're going to tell you, and the remaining 20 to 40% is going to be the conclusion or the wrap-up of what they've told you. Now, the importance of all that is, if one section is far, far longer, you may be being fed a lot of false information. On the other hand, if one of those sections is far shorter, a lot of information, a lot of details that may have linked them to the crime or incident may have been left out. So a lot more information than required, or a lot less of information that they gave you based on those rough percentages. All right, now let's take the last few remaining minutes of this commentary and discuss some random lying indicators. Now, again, I've said this in the first show. You can't hang your hat on one, two, even three or four, perhaps, indicators. You need a cluster. You might need some verbal indicators, some body language indicators, some eye indicators. You want a cluster. Do not ever hang your hat on one indicator. All right, well, let's talk about the first one. Let's talk about invoking God or religion. If someone invokes God or religion into their answers when their religion is not a matter of involvement in the incident, what I mean there is, if this is not a crime of hate based on religion, or a church is not involved, and they just randomly say, look, I swear to God I didn't, or with God as my witness, I didn't do that. If there's no reason to be discussing religion and they invoke God or religion into their answer, you may be being lied to. Now, they also may give you non-committal answers. For instance, they may say, well, I think, best I can remember, I guess, maybe, perhaps. Now, you must keep in mind, however, that they may actually not remember. You know, just because somebody can't remember doesn't mean they're guilty of what you're questioning them about. Again, this is just one indicator. Okay, they may also go on attack when you're asking them questions, especially if you're getting real close to them or getting close to the truth. Why are you asking me such stupid questions? This is a waste of my time. They start attacking in that manner. Another thing they may do is repeat the question back to you in their answer. For instance, did you steal the money? And then they look at you and say, did I steal the money? No, I did not steal the money. That's an indicator. Repeating the question back to you is an indicator of a lie. Perhaps they will give you a mid-sentence jump. Now, what is a mid-sentence jump? It's when they answer the question, but they very abruptly try to change the course of your investigation or the course of what you're asking. For instance, you ask them, did you steal the money? They answer, no, I did not steal that money. By the way, that's a nice shirt. Where did you get that? That's a mid-sentence jump. If they do that, again, an indicator that you're not being told the truth. If you ask a question that requires a yes or a no answer, listen to their answer no. Listen how they answer no. If they say no after a hesitation, that's an indicator of a lie. If they say no and look away, that's an indicator of a lie. If they say no in a singing manner, for instance, no, I did not, that's an indicator of lying. Okay, they may also groom themselves while they're talking to you or answering a question. For instance, if it's a female and she does her makeup, pulls out and does some lipstick, does some hairspray, or if it's a male and combs his hair or straightens his tie, that's an indicator that you're being lied to. Another thing that a liar may do is what we call deflection. They want to deflect the line of questioning. So, for instance, if you say, did you steal the money? And they reply back, steal the money? Why would I do that? All right, now these are just some of the indicators. And again, in 10 minutes, we don't have a lot of time to go over everything. But I wanted to give you some indicators and some information to go on. If you would like more information, you may purchase my book, How to Catch a Liar. It's available on Amazon, Kindle, Books a Million, and Barnes & Noble. I also want to invite you to check out my website. We have a new program, a new seminar, a two-hour seminar that we're giving across the country on forensics for the true crime fan. And this is a really different type of seminar, and it's centered to people who are fans of true crime television or true crime radio shows. This is basically a behind-the-scenes forensic seminar. We discuss such things as fingerprints, ballistics, gunshot residue, crime scene profiling, serial killers. We discuss blood spatter. We even delve into forensic psychology and anthropology. We'll discuss crime scene processing and how that's done. We spend a little bit of time talking about the CSI effect. We'll go over evidence and how evidence is collected. And we'll even talk about insect evidence. And there's a lot more as well. If you want to, just go to my website, www.stephendavidlampley.com, and click on the forensic seminar and get some information. Listen, I appreciate it. I appreciate your support, and I look forward to talking to you again next week. Have a good evening.
Ooh. Welcome back to the House of Mystery, live from Seattle on KKNW 1150 AM. And I'll be your guide today, Al Warren, and the officer on duty is Kev Thompson.
I'm right here.
Of course, you're watching. How you doing today?
Awesome. It is an incredible day. We finally have gotten a day with no rain. The sun is shining. The birds are singing. And I really should be outside mowing the yard, but we can save that for the weekend.
Yeah, save it. Hold on to that. It'll come soon enough. I mean, summer blues are coming. You know, we'll be complaining about that next. So now today we've got an interesting show. We're going to get into something different than we normally do.
Yeah, you can't quite call it conspiracy, but you kind of can, if that makes any sense.
Oh, and there's my favorite music.
Uh-oh.
Mission Impossible. So, okay, now who we've got is, what can I say? He's a former intelligence officer and colonel. And he's written some great books, and the last book was The Secret State, or that's the last book that I picked up of his. His name is Colonel John Hughes Wilson, and he's live from Cyprus. Thanks for being on the show.
Alan, a pleasure, and from a rather dark but warm Cyprus, I hope spring has sprung for you guys on the west coast.
Pretty soon. It's dragging. It's been slow, but that's okay. So now, are we being listened to by the NSA right now?
Of course you are. Absolutely, of course you are. And I think it's naive of you to believe otherwise. And let's not forget, it's not the NSA you have to worry about. It's the Russian SIGINT station. It's British GCHQ. It's everyone is listening to everybody nowadays with digital technology.
Well, Why is that? I guess that's a really silly question, but why would that be? Like, why would the Russians, and we've been hearing a lot about Russians, it's the fall guy right now, but I think there's also Chinese and all sorts of people, but why are they listening to people like us?
Well, they want to know what, not what you're up to, but what America's up to in the broadest sense of the world, and they'll be looking out for what the State Department line is on North Korea, what the State Department and the Department of Defense, speaking American, are going to do about nuclears in Iran, the proliferation there. What's the policy for the Middle East? I mean, there are 101 questions that the spooks out there want to get answers to, and because in the new digital age they can, they are.
Wow. So what do you think about the world as in, there's so much in the political world about Russia and the hacking and WikiLeaks and Assange. What's your take on that whole little category? Like, is it realistic?
Yes, I think it's realistic. And I think we have to be honest. We're living in an age where, Alan, what we say today, tonight, today for you on air, by tomorrow has been overtaken by events. Let me give an example. In The Secret State, I wrote a chapter on cyber war. It's gone. It's overtaken by tomorrow's events. Things are moving so quickly, and we have to take it very seriously. When you look at someone like Assange, now, Assange is basically what, and I don't know if the word translates into American, but in Britain, in old-fashioned criminal word, we would say he's a fence. He's a receiver of stolen goods. Assange is a crook. He's also a real four-letter man, by however you spell it, in every sense of the word. But then you have the other problem, you see. You have your other problem in the States, Snowden. Now, Snowden's an interesting character because Snowden did not do what Assange did. Snowden went to his bosses four times and said, look, boss, we are breaking the law. You are breaking the he actually said, you're breaking the American Constitution, this holy document. You can't do this to the American people. And they patted him on the head and said, there, nice boy, go away, everything's all right. Then eventually, in frustration, Snowden then spills the beans. So you've got a problem. Assange is obviously a crook and a traitor and needs a good kick up the backside. But Snowden, is he a whistleblower or is he a traitor? The answer is he's both. And that's a real problem for modern society.
Yeah, yeah, and Snow, well, you know, when you go to Assange, I'm thinking that he, a perfect example is he used people, like he's like there was that transsexual officer that he gets the he gets the documents, he gets away with it while
yes,
someone
Manning.
Else is, yeah, Manning.
Private Manning.
Yeah, Chelsea Manning now, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, poor old Chelsea Manning, male, female, hermaphrodite, or whatever. He, she, or it is really dropped down the drain by Assange, who uses him, now her, uses him and allows the poor guy to go into the slammer for whatever it is, 30 years. And Assange is a very nasty piece of work.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Now, how does this affect people like you that were, when you're working for, you know, some group like, you know, NSA or Secret Service, you know, CIA, anything like that, how do you deal with someone like Assange and WikiLeaks? How can you, you can't really control that, so, but yet he's still a threat.
No, you're quite right, and that's a very good point. And it's really another indicator of how the world has changed thanks to this, what do they call it, the fourth industrial revolution, or maybe the fifth, I can't remember. But this extraordinary digital revolution we're living through at the moment, where technology is overtaking us all so fast, and so you can't actually form a view of what's right and what's wrong. And the legislators in America on the Hill, they could pass an act tomorrow, but because of cyber war and changing digital technology and mass surveillance, it would be out of date within a week, 6 months.
Yeah, yeah, it doesn't take long, you know. And I could you lay out the groundwork of what the difference is with the USA and their security as compared to, let's say, Britain, because that's a strong ally.
Yeah, well, I think the difference, I mean, I have worked for Americans. And I have to put my cards on the table. I admire America enormously. And that's not BS, that's straight up front. I do admire America. I admire the way Americans do business, and they do things sometimes a lot better than we do the other side of the pond. One of the things that America does badly, and it's not America's fault, it's the way America is. America has not got an integrated all-source intelligence system. What you have, and I looked at it before we came on the show because part of my research, you've either got 16 or 17, and we could argue about that, you've got 16 or 17 national intelligence agencies, from the alcohol, tobacco and firearms, to Homeland Security, the FBI, the NRO, the NSA, DIA, CIA, FBI. What an American friend of mine who worked in the business used to call the alphabet soup of American intelligence agencies. And the problem is, because of the way America does business, and it's very competitive, they're all competing for the boss's ear. Now, it's almost like medieval courtiers trying to get the king's attention. And however quickly, let's say, the CIA sets up a national intelligence organization, the FBI will set up something internally. So you've got this competition. So the guy at the top, whether it's Trump, whether it's Roosevelt in 1941 in Pearl Harbor, he's got a terrible problem. He hasn't got one single voice coming to him and saying, this is the genuine national intelligence estimate on which we all agree, Mr. President. And that's the big difference. In Britain, we have a system which is derided by some of my American friends as the lowest common denominator. We have a thing called the Joint Intelligence Council Committee. And the JIC sits in Whitehall, and it has the head of the Security Service, the head of the Secret Intelligence Service, the head of the SIGINTERS, GCHQ, and all the other intelligence agencies. And they all put their cards on the table, and they all argue about it. And the chairman says, right, this is our considered assessment. There are no minority voices. Do we all agree on this? And everyone says, well, yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then it goes to the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister has to get on with it. Now, I'm not saying that's right, but at least the political decision maker is hearing one clear estimate. And that's the difference between the UK and the US. I don't know which is right. It's a question of national culture, national choice.
I like that idea. I really do. Coming from a military standpoint, back in the 80s, I served in the intelligence field. And you're right. We've got so many different departments, and each one is stovepiped. That's what I see the problem as. They're all stovepiped and really don't want to share information with each other because each one is an aspect of the diamond. Each one has their own agenda. I was DIA, so everything right. to us was military. Has nothing to do with the FBI. You stay over there and you know, DEA, you chase your drugs. We're chasing bad guys. CIA, we're not quite sure what you're doing. And, you know, nobody communicates with each other.
Well, I take your point exactly. And it's not for me to comment on how another country does business. That's a matter for you and your taxpayers and voters. But I would say that this competitive, if you like, push to try and get intelligence through actually has a downside, because it's actually based deep down on money. It's based on the budget. How much budget can my agency get? And then we go into what I think my Vietnamese friends call the rice bowl syndrome, where my rice bowl is more important than your rice bowl, and I'm not going to sell my secrets to you. And so you end up with this extraordinary nonsense over, for example, the World Trade Center. What happened there? Well, the CIA, doing a good job, go into Malaysia with the Malaysian intelligence people. They arrest three guys, and they turn out they're all Al-Qaeda bad guys. And they let them run because, like good intelligence people, they want to follow the lines and see where they're heading. At which point, these three guys head for the continental United States. No one thinks to tell the FBI they should be on a watch list. So the Phoebes watch these three guys come in. They see, and I'm only quoting from American documents I've seen, the ragheads shave their beards off, head up to California, where the sun shines and the girls are there and the booze is cheap, and they live it up, and the FBI watch. And the FBI say, this is nothing important, it's just a bunch of Arabs having a good time in the States. They're away from the Middle East and Saudi Arabia. It then turns out a guy in Phoenix, Arizona, in the FBI, has a walk-in, and the walk-in says, these three guys out in California are going to blow up airplanes.
Yes.
And Phoenix gets onto the New York Terrorist Center, where the FBI have their terrorist center, and says, you better watch out for this, this is serious. What happens then? The lawyers under the Foreign Intelligence Services Act, FISA, come back and say, rather pompously, as only lawyers can, oh, no, you're completely missing the point. The role of the Federal Bureau is not to collect intelligence. It's to prosecute lawbreakers. And so these guys run free. And then they blow up the World Trade Center. It all goes to rats. And when it's all over, the NSA, the National Security Agency, the SIGINT people, put their hand up and say, oh, yeah, we had 33 indications of these people, but we never passed it on because it was secret.
Yes. If only we had known.
It's called joined-up government. Joined-up government.
Yes. Have one central depository for all the intelligence and let somebody sort through it and then prioritize and triage it.
Well, that's what Eisenhower did. Truman did back in 1948-1949. He got hold of Walter Beadle Smith, who was Eisenhower's chief of staff during the war, and a very good combination, and Beadle Smith was set up as the Director of National Intelligence to pull everything together, and he was going to be the only person putting a single national view to the president. And because of the competition, which is throughout American life, like through a stick of rock, that's now gone, and there is no one voice with the presidency giving a unified view.
Yeah. Now, John, if you don't mind me kind of tying our past discussion with this new topic, isn't that kind of, let's go back to Snowden. You've got these intelligence agencies that are collecting everything now. Do you think that that's a knee-jerk reaction to the mistakes that we've made in the past, such as what we just discussed. You know, okay, now we're just going to collect everything. And that's what Snowden saw. There's really no need for you to record my phone calls to my grandmother on my birthday. And how dare you? I think one of Snowden's issues was they were actually using his programs and his software to do this. It was kind of an evolution of Project Echelon.
I think you're right. And I think the point is there, we're back to this point I made earlier about the technological revolution.
Yes.
We do it because we can now. We actually have this facility, and in today's news, it's broken in the States, it's broken all over the world. Your television, your smart TV, is no longer a thing that you watch to see whatever you want to watch. It can actually record you picking your nose and drinking your beer.
Yes, Sony. Sony has now come out with it. I'm serious.
Yeah.
Sony has now come out and admitted our smart TVs are a little bit smarter than you think.
Oh, but the bottom line of that is, if you can, you will, I think is the simple answer to that. And technology has now given the spooks the ability to do whatever they like virtually in digital terms. And so if the opportunity's there, they will. And there you start to run into, are you breaking the law? And that's a question for each nation.
Hmm. Well, now, speaking of breaking the law, we were talking about Manning a little bit ago. Now, I've got mixed feelings, and maybe you can change my mind on this. I've got very little sympathy for Manning, and here's why. What Snowden did, I really honestly, in my heart, I feel that Snowden did because of his convictions.
Correct.
Manning did it more out of anger and made a deal with Assange, you know, be it insidious or be it patriotic, and got tossed under the bus. Is that not just a harsh reality of the intel world?
That's absolutely true, 100% true, and it's a spot-on analysis. And what's happened with Manning was, because of the job Manning was doing, I'm an ex-army officer, an ex-colonel, I've been responsible for things, I would go in a heartbeat and criticize those who were responsible for supervising Manning. He should never have had that level of unsupervised access, and it's the fault of his officers, and I would be after them with a big hatchet.
Well, how do we determine nowadays, being in intelligence, how is it that you would determine, just as we would, what all this talk about alternative and fake news and what's real and what's not? And again, isn't that a problem for security agencies to control? It's very influential. People follow things around and they don't know what to believe. They avoid media. They it's really a gray area right now. And do you think that there may be some of the security agencies are behind some of this fake information?
Well, I can answer that. If it's on Alex Jones, it's true.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you hit there are two points to that. First of all, of course, the security agencies will exploit the technology. And the question you've asked actually homes in on another change in technology, social media. And that's where fake news emanates. Because what's that lovely saying? Someone said, by the time truth's got its boots on, the lie has gone round the world. And that's what happens with social media. Someone comes up and says, John Hughes Wilson is a Soviet agent and always was ever since 1972. By the time I see, you see, I'm not on Facebook for security reasons. By the time the BBC phone me up tomorrow morning and tell me that, and I have to say, guys, it's not true. It really is not true. By the time they phone me up and tell me that, it's gone on Facebook around the world with millions of likes. And, oh, Hughes Wilson was a Soviet spy the whole time. And that's the problem with fake news. Its source is actually social media. The question in a modern democracy, and don't look at me, I'm not a politician, how the hell do you control social media?
Yeah, yeah. And it's really bad when we see our political leaders buy in or repeat some of the fake news.
Yeah, I mean, but how do you know what's real and what's fake? Someone comes up and says, let me think of an example. Queen Elizabeth is actually a secret lizard. Queen Elizabeth of England is a secret lizard, which is what one guy, David Icke, says, and she's a shapeshifter. And the world is run by aliens disguised as lizards who are pretending to be human beings. How do you stop that kind of thing on social media? Because somewhere out there in... I'm going to say something very rude. Somewhere out there in some town in the Midwest, there's some simple country boy who hears this and says, "Hey, boys, did you know that the Queen of England, well, she's a lizard?"
Yeah.
How do you stop that?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Probably someone down in Alabama area, but...
Hang on, I've got some good friends in Alabama.
Oh, that's an inside joke, because Kevin comes out of Alabama. So. That's kind of... Now, I have to say, first of all, that, John, you got into the writing and you wrote about the blunders of intelligence. Yep. And that actually became a textbook, so people are using it. So you are very authoritative. You're very good at what you do.
That's very kind. I must tell you the honest truth. I wrote that book in 6 weeks.
Wow.
And I am astonished that it's become a textbook and so forth in universities and so on. But someone said to me a long time afterwards, I think on a BBC television program, how long did it take you to write the book? And my agent was in the room and my publisher was in the room. They're looking at me. And I said, well, actually, the writing only took 6 weeks. And they both looked at me, glowered at me. And I said, but it took 25 years to prepare.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Experiences.
Yeah. And so what do you think the biggest fiascos are? Is it 9/11 and even the JFK assassination? Was that kind of was that bad intelligence?
No, I think picking this off one by one, JFK was not bad intelligence. There is no doubt at all in my mind from the evidence I've seen and looked at and checked on very carefully that LBJ and J. Edgar Hoover knew what was going on. They were, if not involved directly, they were complicit. They knew what was going down. Now, when you go back to the other things, I would say, and I'm speaking obviously to an American audience, I would say the two things that if I were a United States citizen that I would be looking at very hard and wanting to know the real truth about would be Pearl Harbor, which is an absolute disaster of bad intelligence and no dissemination and getting it completely wrong. And then by 1945, America has produce the most amazing intelligence organization in the world, really incredibly good. And then you come up to the World Trade Center, and you look at the World Trade Center, and your heart breaks for what happens on 9/11, because the United States intelligence agencies had all the cards in their hand. They knew what was going on. They just, for some reason, even now, I can't get my head around it, didn't get it right. It was just a huge intelligence disaster, the worst one I can think of in my life, in my career.
And how do we handle a big thing going on in the U.S. lately, in the last year or two, has been things like the Alex Jones show, and like a lot of, there's this big contingency that say it's false flags. There's people that say 9/11 didn't really happen, and all the shootings in the States aren't happening. They're just false flags. They're actors. They've even said the one in Paris didn't happen. Now,
of course it is.
Yeah, well, that's what, you know, from an intelligence agency, how do you handle that? Because there's a strong group of people that believe that, you know, followers.
Well, you've got a problem in the States, as we do in Britain, where you've got this extraordinary people who watch television with a can of beer, a six-pack of beer, and a packet of crisps or pretzels or whatever, and they actually believe that the moon landing never took place, but the wrestling is not rigged.
Yeah. So
I mean, that's what you're up against.
But isn't that harmful in the big picture? And also from an intelligent agents, how do they handle that? Like when they're dealing with a population that sort of goes, well, you're faking it. Because what I'm getting at here is that there's this huge mistrust for intelligent agencies. And that's an example, because of what's going on with Trump, for instance, right now, and Russia and all this sort of stuff, and that comes out from the intelligence group saying that, okay, you know, it was hacked and Russia's involved and he's in with Trump and all this. And then, of course, you got him saying, no, Obama's tapped him and blah, blah, blah. But how is that going to repair itself? Because right now, either way you believe it, you either don't believe your president or you don't believe your intelligence agency. So how does that get repaired from, let's say, the CIA?
Well, that's a difficult question, because the question you're posing is the, if you like, the end result. You have to go back to the start of it all. First of all, we have to ask ourselves some very simple questions. Is the Kremlin, are the Russians spying and trying to influence the American political system and American life generally? You bet your backside they are. Of course they are. That's what they're paid to do. Equally, I would say, as a professional in the business, if I were an American taxpayer and I thought that the CIA were not trying to rig the results of the Ukrainian election or what was going on inside Russia, I'd be demanding my tax dollars back, because we all spy on each other. Spying is eternal. We're all trying to interfere with each other. The Brits are trying to mess around with the Europeans at the moment, and the Europeans are trying to mess with the Brits. It goes on all the time. So that's a given. Now, when it impacts on internal politics, it becomes serious. Did the Russians try to influence the election by going for the Democratic National Congress? Leaked emails? I suspect they did. Were the FBI, the NSA and the CIA trying to find out what was going on inside Trump's campaign? A very good question. I don't know the answer, and I wouldn't, as a non-American, venture an opinion. I wouldn't dare to. That's not my business. But you've then got a problem, because you now have the president, the 45th president of the United States, and the president of the United States is a very important figure, whether he's a little green man from Mars, who happened to be born in the States, or he's whatever. But he's the president of the United States, and that's the point. If he's in conflict with his intelligence agencies, that's a very serious domestic matter for the United States, and one that's got to be reconciled.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite worrisome. Is it up to the intelligence agencies, like, that he's having conflict with, to try and improve that?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I would think in terms of normal relations, and in politics you can't really use that kind of phrase, because politics are abnormal relations. But in normal relations, if that were between, for example, Al, you and me, we'd be trying to sort it out and find a compromise. And I think that's the way to go. But either Trump is mistaken or the agencies are lying, and I don't know the answer to that.
And that's where I'd like to jump in. Would it be fair to say, then, having said all of that, that our intelligence agencies have actually been weaponized in order to create a public mindset, either be it for the president or against the president? Like Al was talking, you know, you've got fake news over here, and you've got the mainstream media over here, and everybody is claiming to have these sources in these intelligence agencies.
Kevin, you're right. No, Kevin, you're smack on the button. And here I'm going to pull my horns in a bit and become a Brit for this. In Britain, we have a thing called the Official Secrets Act. If a British intelligence officer in one of the agencies was discovered leaking information to a political party, he would be in the Old Bailey and in the slammer before you could say Jack Robinson. We take a very tough line on officials who leak. I'm talking about treacherous leaking. Now, if you're leaking for political advantage, that's even worse, because it means, and here's the real crunch for Capitol Hill, for D.C., what did Trump call it, the swamp? Yes. If you have a civil service that you can't trust, you guys have got a big, big problem, because whichever guy is in power, be it Democrat, be it Republican, you've got to put your hand on your heart and say, I salute the Republic, I'm here for the President, I will serve as I'm told. You can't say, I'm here to serve the Democratic National Congress or the Republicans on the Hill. You cannot have political leakages in intelligence.
No, I agree. I agree 100%. And it seems, from all appearances, it seems that they have been. Me and Al joke back and forth about Alex Jones, me being a fan, just purely out of entertainment reasons, but he always claims to have these inside sources or NSA sources and what have you. If that is true, that you have these intel agencies intentionally leaking information, how do we fix that? Well, what do we do? Since we're so deep in.
Well, the answer is, and I'm the first man to put my hands up, I don't know. If you suddenly discover your civil service, which is what we're talking about, is not fit for purpose because it's become politically corrupted or politically biased, you then have to sit back and take a long, slow look at your civil service. Now, as I understand it, and here you can advise me, when he comes to town, he brings with him his political advisors. Am I correct?
Yes. Yes, you are.
So those political advisors, we can assume, will be partisan, within the meaning of the word, and potentially will leak if it suits them. They're not the ones that bother me. It's the guy who's sitting in the bowels of Fort Meade, Maryland, and he decides he doesn't like... He doesn't like President Trump for whatever reason, for example. And he then decides he's going to leak something he's seen to the New York Times or the Washington Post. That is wrong. It's not only wrong in legal terms, it's wrong in moral terms, because the civil service has to be neutral. It has to serve the executive. Now, that's my view from the outside. I'm not an American.
Yeah, yeah. Where do you see all this going? Do you think this is going to be a real bumpy road for a while?
Oh, I think, looking at it from the outside, I'm very old, you know, very, very old. I've been looking at American politics for many, many years. The thing is, America now, and I find this a tragedy because I've got lots of good American friends, and I like America enormously, and I do, and I'm not saying that to flatter, but America is now more polarized than I've ever seen it in my life. 20 years ago, you talk to guys at a party or something in Washington or New York, and a guy would be a Republican, a guy would be a Democrat, and you'd argue about policies and things, and it was okay, you wouldn't agree, but it was a kind of civilized discourse.
Yes.
Nowadays, I must say, as a foreigner, and I am a foreigner in America, you pick up an American newspaper and you think there's a bloody civil war going on. You read stuff from California and they're talking about we're going to secede from the Union. Excuse me? What? But that's actually floating around. You get people saying Trump is the new Hitler. Excuse me? Hitler killed 6 million Jews, had a Holocaust, and was a genocidal maniac. Now, you may not like Donald Trump. You may think all kinds of things about him. But I don't think he's going to do stuff like that. What kind of language is this? What kind of political ping-pong is this?
Yeah, yeah. It is really strange, and we live it. So I don't know what to say. It just it makes things hard because people are so extreme back and forth. With these sort of things. And when you talk about, you know, we had Admiral Kimmel from Pearl Harbor. We had his grandsons because, you know, they're going around trying to get his rank back.
Wonderful.
And great show, great men. And do you think that there's a considered kind of a conspiracy against this happening?
Against what happening?
Against the Admiral getting his rank back. Like, you know, he really...
I suspect there is, and it's a criminal, because the two guys who really are shafted by the American system are Admiral Kimmel and the General Ashore. What's his name? Schultz?
Yeah, that's right.
And they are completely shafted and dropped down the well by the American system. And actually, if you look at Kimmel, who is a good guy, and he turns round and he says, 2 days before Pearl Harbor, to his staff, "So we don't know quite where this Japanese carrier fleet is." "No, sir." And he then says, "So they could be rounding Diamond Head at any moment." "Well, we hope not, Admiral." Now, Kimmel does everything right, but he's, as I say, dropped down the well by the system. And he gets the warning of war message 2 days before. His only crime is he didn't sail his fleet and get out to sea and disperse them and issue live ammunition. And that, you know, on a warning of war, is not quite the same as they're coming tomorrow. So my sympathies have always been with the two commanders on Hawaii.
Yeah, that's sort of why we did the show, and I even still have the petition up on our website. It's important. And there's a lot of conspiracy out of there that the president at the time knew Pearl Harbor was going to happen. When you guys hear things like that as intelligence, do you check it out, or do you just sort of laugh?
Well, I mean, you never laugh at it, and I don't.
Yeah.
I don't think for a moment that Roosevelt really thought that it was going to happen the way it did. Every sensible guy in the States knew that something was going to happen. Why? Because America had 6 months before said to the Japanese, "We're going to cut your oil supplies off." Now, the thinking back in the State Department was, well, of course, that'll bring the Japanese to heel. Anyone who knew anything about the kind of shogunate mentality of the Japanese would say, "No, the Japanese will not roll over and let their tummy be tickled. They'll come and attack. They'll come and grab it." And that's what happens at Pearl Harbor. The main targets of the Japanese attack on the 7th of December 1941 are the Dutch East Indies oil, the British rubber and tin of Malaysia. That's what they're after. They're after seizing essential supplies, which the Americans have turned off for them.
I was going to get just a tad bit conspiratorial. There's a story that has been circulated around. It's not in high circulation anymore, that the attack on Pearl Harbor was actually partially instigated by Hitler's people as a distraction to keep us out of, you know, out of Europe.
That's not true. I do have firm intelligence on. That's not true. Hitler and his Abwehr are busy getting a brief from the Japanese saying, "Please tell us what's going on in Pearl Harbor." That's the only German involvement with Pearl Harbor. And, of course, the Japanese are fascinated by Pearl Harbor because they are looking if they can attack it. Yamamoto advises them not to. Yamamoto says, "I'll run amok for 6 months." But he's the only Japanese guy who's actually been to the States. He's seen the power, the muscle of America, industrial might. And he says, "I can't sustain it after 6 months." And one of the things that Americans find very hard to grasp, and it's true, and it's unfortunate because you lost 3,000 guys there, Pearl Harbor is almost a sideshow to the real Japanese intent, which is to take over the industrial heartland of the Far East. And neutralizing the American fleet is a kind of put your left hand out and push them away. And, of course, it goes wrong.
So the Cold War, is it really over, or was it ever really over? Or is it just, you know, like, you know, you hear all this stuff about, okay, the Cold War was ended, and then now it's back, coming back again. Like, what's the whole take on Cold War thing?
Oh, boy.
Well, the Cold War is interesting because it all, Ronnie Reagan, whatever you think about him, whatever you say about him, Ronnie Reagan pulls off one of the biggest stunts that America could have pulled off since the Second World War. He basically is playing poker with the Soviet Union, and he's got a bigger stack of chips. And this business, what did he call it? Star Wars, yes?
Yeah.
And there comes a moment where the United States, Ronnie Reagan, is putting chips on the table, saying we're going to develop this outside space defensive nuclear system. And I don't know, but it has to be true. At some point, the head of the Soviet Air Force goes in to see Andropov, or one of these aging geriatric Soviet leaders, and he says, we need more money to build a Star Wars system. And Andropov, or whatever it is, throws his hands up in horror, and we know that Gorbachev certainly just did, and said, we can't afford it. It's not a question of guns or butter for the Soviet Union now. We don't have any butter, and we can't afford the guns. And so Ronnie Reagan breaks in this extraordinary poker game. He breaks the Soviet Union, and the Cold War's over, finished. Now, that leaves a terrible period for the Russians, where there are no pensions, the country collapses. That's where Putin comes in. Putin looks back, he sees the Soviet Union as being powerful, and he wants to make Mother Russia, strong again. Quite rightly so. He's as good a nationalist as anyone coming out of Montana or Kansas. He believes in Russia. You believe in that. Yeah. So he is saying, comrades, we want to make Russia great again. And, of course, that's exactly what he's doing. He's got a defense budget that I think is 1/11th, and basically try and make Russia look good. Partly, gentlemen, for domestic reasons. Because if he wants to hold on to power, he's got to look and be what the Russians call a vojd, and that's a strong man, a strong leader. And that's what Russians want and like.
So now I was going to ask you about the secret state. You called your book that. Do you believe in a shadow government, or there's really a kind of a hidden government of Rothschilds and people that are running the whole world, and we don't get to vote for president and your prime minister and stuff? They're all selected for you by really the shadow government.
Wow, that's really conspiratorial.
Yeah.
I think what happens is, and you can see it's happening in Turkey. I live in the Turkish Republic of North Cyprus. And Erdogan, who's now the president of Turkey, he genuinely believes that there's some kind of secret state with civil servants and judges and army officers against him. Now, Erdogan, has moved against them. And he's had his kind of mini, after the coup, he's had his maxi repression and clampdown. And I think that's, quite honestly, a reasonable assumption. And I think if you look at any country, there is a kind of secret state in the sense of the people who are the middle managers, maybe the senior guys in the various government agencies, who all have a kind of group think. Now, whether you then move from that to the one world order, the new world order, to the Rothschilds pulling the strings, is quite a big jump. I personally don't think, well, it's a tough one. I don't think that's the case. And yet when you look at people like Rockefeller Jr. and the Rothschilds, and they will say, the whole purpose of our life has been to set up a one world order. So that's one I would say, honestly, Al, I think the answer is I don't know, and I think the jury is out.
Well, there you go. Now,
well, I'm going to beg to differ, John. For example, you know, you were using Turkey as an example. Well, let's use America as an example. Like it or not, Trump is president.
Yep.
And so that's established. You know, I'm fairly certain that he did, you know, he won the Electoral College. Yep. However, now that he's, you know, executing these orders, you have got parties that are just sitting back saying, fine, you can issue all the orders that you want, but we're not going to enforce them. We're not going to agree with them. In fact, we're going to pass our own, regardless of what you say or think. So me, as the average working, you know, stiff, what am I supposed to think when, again, let's go back, you know, to, you know, fake news, whatever you want to call it, when they're saying, well, look, right here, you've got this party over here that's doing this against Trump.
Kevin, go on.
No, I mean, can we not safely assume that there is somebody back in the shadows, you know, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain kind of thing?
Wow. Well, I that's an interesting point. I think the word I used, it's a very interesting point. I think the word that I used a couple of sentences back might be appropriate, what I call groupthink.
Yes, sir.
And I think inside the U.S. administration, there is a lot of groupthink at the moment. And, I don't want to tie political labels on it, but all I would say, basically, it's anti-Trump. Now, the groupthink will then decide to oppose him. My view as a taxpayer and a citizen is that's wrong, because if, in my case, Her Majesty's government pays civil servants to do what the government, the executive of the day, says, and they don't, that's disloyal and treasonous and traitorous and very serious. And I think that's the question I would pose to the people who might be tempted to do that in the United States or any other country. If you take the Queen's shilling, you do what's required of you. If you don't like it, you can always resign and give up your pension. And we don't see a lot of that. And we go back to the point I made earlier, Kevin, and you're onto something really important here, what's going on in America, very important. You're back to this extraordinary polarization of American political life, which has to be bad.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's difficult to get around sometimes, because people are so one-sided, and there's no middle ground to meet up. Mm. So that makes it difficult.
Absolutely.
What have you got planned next? Are you what's next for John?
Next for me is it's coming up to 11 o'clock here. no, it's gone ten. I'll be heading for a glass of good Scotch malt whiskey and water, and then heading for bed. But that's not the answer you want. What's next for me? The London Book Fair is next week, which is one of these big banyans which they have all over the place. And my agent's got 3 new books which he's going to try and flog, and we're moving on in that direction. And I would hope, and I'm not saying it to plug the book, I would genuinely hope that The Secret State and Intelligence Blunders is read by more people in America, because there are ideas in it. One of the problems Americans have is there's a kind of not invented here syndrome, and Americans need to take their eyes and look outside America and see what's going on. And that is important because it impacts on what's happening in Louisiana, in Kentucky. All these things from outside have an impact. And when you're in state, you and I know this because we've both been there. People tend to forget that.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I'll tell you, the book is just fantastic. I recommend it. We'll have it up on our website. It's called The Secret State, and it's a history of intelligence and espionage. And our guest has been Colonel John Hughes Wilson. Thank you for being on the show.
Gentlemen, it has been a pleasure, a genuine pleasure, and if ever you feel minded to ask me back again to talk on some other subject without deviation, hesitation, or repetition, I'd be happy to do so.
Sir, it has been an absolute honor. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
mission have been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.